to discuss Sri Lanka's attempt at receiving a loan from the IMF and its impact on the country's economy.
This year's monsoon rains have hit Pakistan hard, causing the worst flooding in the past 30 years. Extreme heat waves and monsoon winds led to unprecedented rainfall that submerged millions of acres of farms in water. Now, a third of Pakistan is underwater, and the consequences of this crisis are affecting all aspects of life for the people. Pakistan, which was already struggling with political turmoil and economic hardships, is now facing a series of humanitarian crises and environmental disasters.
Pakistan is ranked 8th in the list of countries most at risk of being a victim of global climate change. This year, it witnessed a 780% increase in average rainfall compared to the past three decades. Extreme heat, high humidity, and glacial meltdowns, in addition to widespread poverty in the country, have led the country to a deadly crisis. Villages are disappearing in the water one after the other, and more than a million houses are in ruins. The death toll has passed 1,200, while more than 33 million people have lost their homes. Pakistan was already troubled with not just political problems, but a range of economic issues such as high inflation, currency devaluation, and a budget deficit. Now, with the devastation of farms and vital infrastructures such as roads, bridges, schools, hospitals, and public health infrastructure, food prices and supply chain issues are expected to follow, with the possibility of viral disease epidemics. A crisis that, according to Pakistani officials, was caused by irresponsible environmental policies applied elsewhere in the world, especially in wealthier nations.
The recent floods in Pakistan has caused major crises in two sectors, food and health. The country's prime minister has estimated more than $10 billion in the loss of infrastructure, homes and farms, and thus requested aid from the global community. The UN Refugee Agency has demanded $160 million to cover the cost of relief projects for Pakistani flood victims. The majority of the victims are predominantly poor villagers who are not just at the risk of hunger, but viral diseases as well.
In 2022, Pakistan experienced an extraordinary heat wave. Most of the cities in the country experienced an average of 40 degrees Celsius temperature. This excessive heat caused an increase in overall humidity levels, leading to an increase in monsoon rainfalls up to three times the average recorded in the past 30 years. On the other hand, the record-breaking heat waves initiated glacial meltdowns in the Himalayan mountains that streamed into Pakistan's north. Statistics show that Pakistan is responsible for less than 1% of total global carbon emissions. In fact, Pakistan is responsible for 0.4% of global carbon emissions since 1959. Meanwhile, wealthy developed countries which consume most of the fossil fuel reserves, like the U.S. and China, have the highest share of carbon emissions, amounting to roughly 21.5% and 16.4% respectively. The resulting flood from environmental changes has almost destroyed the most important sector in Pakistan's economy. Agriculture makes up about a quarter of the country's GDP, while nearly 40% of the workforce is employed in this sector or related professions. With the loss of millions of acres of farms, it's safe to say that Pakistan's agriculture is facing an apocalypse. Once a major exporter of agricultural products, Pakistan should now consider imports.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Athar Hussain, the head of the Center for Climate Research and Development in Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Hussain. Now, this year's floods in Pakistan are unprecedented, as nearly a third of Pakistan has been submerged in water. So why is this happening to Pakistan despite its relatively small share of global carbon emissions?
Yeah, that's right. The share of the carbon dioxide emission from Pakistan is less than 1%. But the problem is that as soon as the carbon dioxide goes in the atmosphere, it doesn't care where from it is coming. So it gets spread out equally. So as a result, the temperature rises practically everywhere on the surface of the earth. And since the geography and the terrain of Pakistan is such that it has not high mountains in the north and Arabian Sea in the south, So this provides a very effective combination for any change in the climate to disrupt the normal monsoon pattern. So this is the reason that this year several combination of weather patterns work together to produce a more than above normal rainfall in the monsoon period.
So Mr. Hossain, why haven't we seen the same enthusiasm for humanitarian aid to disaster-struck countries in the subcontinent region as we saw in the case of Ukraine?
Well, I have seen many examples, such as we ourselves contributed towards the flood relief camp. And secondly, several Islamic countries started it in the very first moments when the call came out from the government of Pakistan, such as UAE, Turkey, and other nations then joined the hands. So there is, of course, it is less than what is required, but the aid is pouring in. And even today I heard that, see the news that UN has sent 4 planes of supply to support the needed.
Mr. Hossain, how can relief operations take place in such widespread flooding when supposedly administrative and emergency response buildings are also underwater?
Well, then we have the supply from dropping from the helicopters and other similar support systems to support the persons. And in nearby areas where there is no devastation due to flood, the government system is working, and then up to that point the support is available by land, and then it is by through the boats and other support systems that can run over the water.
Last but not least, Mr. Hossain, what can the rest of the world do to deal with climate change and rising temperatures that cause the glacial meltdowns? And also, is there hope to prevent such disasters from happening in the future?
Yeah, this is now more and more demanding collective wisdom from all of us. The culprit for the rise in temperature is the anthropogenic increase in the carbon dioxide. So as soon as we start thinking more seriously and collaborating with each other, the amount of carbon should have to be reduced that is going into the atmosphere. And then as a result, the temperature will be rising less slowly, and as a result these significant climate changes that are occurring will be occurring at a much lower space and speed as they were occurring previously, and these for which the different capacity persons can be adjusted, can be made adaptable to these non-significant climate changes. This is a situation which is demanding a lot of collaboration, and more efforts need to be done in terms of doing the regional climate modeling so that we understand better the changing patterns, and also the planning on behalf of the regional government so that such large-scale devastations can be minimized.
There you have it, Mr. Hossain, the head of the Center for Climate Research and Development at Islamabad campus. Thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Member of the British Parliament for Leicester East, Claudia Webb, pointed to the climate catastrophe in the country by mentioning the recent floods, wildfires, and melting glaciers. She asked for cancelling the country's debt and paying the country the climate compensation. Former Prime Minister of Islamic Republic of Pakistan, Imran Khan, stated that the people need to understand the disastrous impact of global climate change and warn against imperative changes the country is making to the environment. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, Karachi-based artist, asked for cancellation of the Pakistan debt in an interview with MSNBC channel, warning that otherwise people will starve.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Sri Lanka has been grappling with crippling inflation, currency devaluation, shortage of fuel and food supplies, and unparalleled social unrest for months. It's now suffering from its worst financial crisis since its independence from Britain in 1948. Cash flow insolvency has forced the government to once again ask for financial assistance from the IMF, an act that could satisfy previous creditors but could lead to unpleasant consequences for the South Asian nation.
Sri Lanka is experiencing another cash flow problem, with its economy trapped in a downward spiral. Since the beginning of March 2022, Sri Lankan rupee has devalued against the U.S. dollar by roughly 45%. Its currency reserves are almost depleted, with less than $1 billion. Meanwhile, the island nation is expected to return $4 billion U.S. dollars worth of debt in the final quarter of 2022, including $1 billion of international sovereign bonds that were supposed to be repaid by January 2022. Sri Lanka's foreign debt stands at a staggering $51 billion U.S. dollars, and most of it is owed to multilateral creditors and government bonds. This debt has expanded in recent years due to tax reductions and irresponsible expenditure on major infrastructural projects. The final blow was the COVID-19 pandemic, which deprived the country of billions of dollars in foreign remittance and tourism income. This predicament has forced the Sri Lankan government to request an emergency loan of $2.9 billion U.S. dollars, which is still pending a final verification by the IMF Board of Directors. The agreement mandates major reforms in the country's economy in order to decrease financial deficits. It also includes agreements with creditors such as Japan, China, and India to extend the repayment deadlines for the country's astronomical foreign debt.
Sri Lanka is one of the clear examples of a third-world country that has turned into a battlefield for international financial organizations and regional and global superpowers. The country's vulnerabilities have made it an ample target for international financial organizations. These organizations are strictly prohibited from interfering in the political affairs of their client states. But in reality, they have turned into powerful political players with an aptitude to impact the economies of third world countries.
The International Monetary Fund and World Bank are international financial institutions and part of the legacy of Bretton Woods. Since 1944, the IMF and the World Bank have influenced the global financial order as two main intergovernmental organizations, and Sri Lanka has repeatedly interacted with both of these institutions. Now the country is facing critical conditions, including a shortage of food and fuel, power outages, and an insufficient supply of medical items and other goods. Privatization of state-owned enterprises and a shift to an export-based economy can provide Sri Lanka with sufficient foreign currency reserves, but implementing these policies requires overcoming pressure from powerful organizations. To escape the current crisis, Sri Lanka is appealing to regional superpowers to avoid its economic fallout. But by doing so, it has complicated its financial status and is now seeking aid from international organizations that force their own policies on poorer nations, disguised as harmless humanitarian assistance. United Nations assessment on World Bank policies has shown that this organization is, for most purposes, the World Bank is currently a human rights free zone. In its operational policies in particular, it treats human rights more like an infectious disease than universal values and obligations. This is how international financial organizations practice neocolonialism.
Now, to talk more on this, I would like to welcome Mr. C.P. Chandrasekhar. He's an economic columnist, a senior research fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts in New Delhi, India. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the extended fund facility is meant to resolve the issue of cash flow in Sri Lanka, but the question is cash flow the real cause of the problem?
Well, you know, the extended finance facility is supposed to be not just a cash flow issue. It's supposed to put in place a set of conditions reflected in a letter of intent, which the government concerns provides to the IMF. And we know the kind of conditionality associated with the IMF loans. And if you look at it in practice, what we have is
$2.9 billion going into Sri Lanka as part of this agreement if it goes through the board. And what is known is that Sri Lanka's total outstanding debt stock is something like $51 billion. So $3 billion, even if it's going to come through, it's going to come through in a period over of you know, something like 3 to 4 years. And what you have is a large part of this $51 billion having to be paid off over the coming 2-3 years. So I wouldn't even say that this is an effort to resolve a cash flow. What it is really for the IMF to try and tell private financial investors that we are getting this country to adopt a set of policies which would be in keeping with what you think is appropriate. So we are de-risking the environment such that you will come in with additional cash or additional support, essentially, or not additional support, but additional lending. So unless there is a larger package in which not just bilateral lenders, but also private financial firms and bondholders of different kinds come in and work out a rescheduling exercise, it's not going to work. So I wouldn't even say that this is a cash flow adjustment. This is an adjustment. I mean, this is a process of de-risking the environment, or attempt at de-risking the environment for international private investors.
Sir, this is the 17th time that Sri Lanka receives aid from the IMF. At this point, we must ask, why do these programs keep failing in reviving the Sri Lankan economy?
So, yeah, that only sort of confirms what I've just said, that essentially, if you have a country which has, ever since the first IMF loan, adopted a set of policies which are in keeping with what the IMF wanted, it was a country which actually was performing quite well, particularly if you look at it in terms of the human development or welfare indicators. Sri Lanka was one of the developing countries across the globe, but definitely in the Asian region, in the Asia-Pacific region, which was performing really well. You take a country like that and put it through a transition, which is a neoliberal transition in terms of economic policy, and you end up with a situation where you don't really resolve the balance of payments difficulties of a country which, it is true, is dependent on a few sources of foreign exchange earnings. I mean, it's dependent on incomes from tourism, it is dependent on to a certain extent on garment exports, and it is dependent on remittances from Sri Lankan workers abroad. That if you have a few sources of income, obviously you're vulnerable. So instead of actually working on a strategy which would help that economy diversify in terms of its ability to be able to earn foreign exchange and diversify such that it can reduce its dependence on imports so that outflows of foreign exchange are lower. If you had a program of that kind, then you shouldn't have had a situation where they have to keep going back to the IMF, where actually you have these 17, I mean, this is the 17th, you have 16 different instances in which they've gone. So I would actually say that the reason why the IMF keeps coming back, even though it's very clear that what it tried to do in the past is a failure, is because what it's trying to do is not really put the country on a trajectory which allows it to overcome its structural vulnerabilities and be to a certain extent sort of resilient vis-a-vis balance of payment shocks. But really what it aims to do is to create an environment in which there is a degree of confidence created for international investors to de-risk the environment for international investors, particularly for international lenders. It is in some sense getting the country caught in a debt trap, but in a way in which the losers will not be the international, you know, lenders who without due diligence have actually been providing large credits to many countries which are on the verge or actually have defaulted, like Sri Lanka has for the first time. That it really is de-risking these countries to say that you're not going to be the loser. If anybody is the loser, it's going to be, the population of the country, in particular, given inequality, the poor populations of these countries.
Sir, it's known that the IMF is notorious for its predatory lending policies that perpetuate financial troubles. So is another deal the solution that Sri Lankans should be seeking?
You see, the point is it's very clear in principle what a country like Sri Lanka needs at the moment, because it is true that it saw a collapse in its foreign exchange reserves because it has elements of balance payments vulnerability, and then a combination of the sudden stop in global economic activity, and particularly on the receipts from tourism, which came as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath and the response to the COVID-19 pandemic in terms of brutal lockouts or lockdowns all over the world, that it actually, because of that and because of the fact that post the Ukrainian invasion, it's the imports that it was dependent on, both of in particular of commodities like fertilizer, energy, etc., that these the dollar prices of these went up quite sharply, it had seen a collapse in its reserves. Okay, so if that be the case, what we need is the following. It basically is a situation where Sri Lanka is saying that, listen, we've accumulated this debt. We are not in a position to be able to find the foreign exchange. It's not that you can print Sri Lankan rupees and meet your debt service commitments. You have to transform your Sri Lankan commodities or Sri Lankan rupees into foreign exchange, into hard currency, to be able to service this external debt. So what is needed is very clear. First, there is need for multilateral and bilateral creditors to actually examine the situation and write off a significant share of debt such so that it becomes feasible to be able to address the debt problem. Secondly, it's necessary for a large number of the private investors who have over a period of time bought into Sri Lankan sovereign bonds to accept a significant haircut, as well as allow for a degree of rescheduling. And third, since even if you manage to restructure and reschedule debt, that doesn't mean Sri Lanka's need for foreign exchange is going to vanish overnight. You need a process by which you could ensure the flow of concessional liquidity to Sri Lanka for a period of time. And finally, in that period of time, you need to put in place a strategy which, as I said, would diversify the economy such that the export earnings become larger and more sustained. And import earnings and import outflows are reduced by actually producing domestically a set of commodities, in particular food, which Sri Lanka tends to export over import over a period of time. So unless you have this whole package, some debt write-off, some restructuring of debt of private debt involving significant haircuts and rescheduling, some degree of liquidity inflow in concessional terms to allow Sri Lanka over the coming, couple of years or 3-4 years to tide over the difficulties it is facing. And finally, a non-neoliberal development package which allows it to diversify its economic structure so as to be able to reduce its import dependence and increase its export earnings. That is the only way in which you can actually resolve this without going in for another 18th, 19th, 20th or 21st IMF loan.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Chandrasekhar for being on the program. He's an economic columnist, a senior research fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, New Delhi, India. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Andrew Fiddle Fernando, Colombo-based journalist and author of Upon a Sleepless Isle, slammed the IMF deal with Sri Lanka, stating the country's declining standard of living and costs rise compared to income. Ex-global youth worker and political activist Sankha Chandima Abaya Wardena asked for publishing of the complete Sri Lanka IMF deal, stating that people have a right to know. Joe Wallen, the Telegraph's Southeast Asia foreign correspondent, pointed to the Sri Lanka's borrowing complexities and added that if it is going to get to a sustainable level, Beijing, New Delhi, Tokyo, multilaterals, and global asset managers must all swallow losses.
And that was our episode about the unprecedented and devastating floods in Pakistan and the resulting crises. And also, Sri Lanka's attempt at receiving a loan from the IMF and its impact on the country's economy. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
Israel, the world's eighth largest nuclear power, initiated its nuclear program in 1952 with technological support from France and the United States of America, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Today, the Israeli regime possesses over 90 nuclear warheads with enough plutonium to produce at least 200 nuclear weapons. We now present you an article written by Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer. The piece is titled Ehud Barak's Empty Threat. Please stay with us for more of Scott Ritter's article. Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of the Israeli regime, recently published an opinion piece in Time, where he concludes that Iran could be days away from reaching what he terms threshold nuclear status, namely possessing enough enriched uranium to manufacture a single nuclear device. Ehud Barak acknowledges that even if Iran were to accumulate the required stock of enriched uranium to cross this threshold, it would still need 18 to 24 months to polish their skills treating metal uranium and packing it into a missile warhead. According to Barak, this is a mere technicality which Iran can overcome at any time. Barak contends Iran is about to cross the point of no return in becoming a member of the nuclear club. Left unsaid by Barak is the fact that Israel is itself a member of this club, having built a nuclear weapons program outside the framework of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, which the Zionist regime has not joined. It seems that hypocrisy knows no bounds. Israel, the world's eighth largest nuclear power, initiated its clandestine nuclear program in 1952 with technological support from France and the United States, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful nuclear program. According to military think tanks, the first nuclear weapons were developed by Tel Aviv regime somewhere around 1967-1968. After that, the production accelerated rapidly, with zero internal outcry. Today, the regime possesses over 90 nuclear warheads with enough plutonium to produce at least 200 nuclear warheads. Around 5 kilograms of weapons-grade plutonium is required for one nuclear bomb. What has emboldened the Tel Aviv regime to accelerate its nuclear activities while wrapping a cloak of secrecy around them is Western sponsorship made possible by Zionist lobbying groups in the United States and Europe. The two countries most critical of Iran's nuclear program are Israel's staunchest allies, who helped the regime become a nuclear power. Israel's weapons-grade fissile material stocks originated in France in the 1960s, and the United States in the late 1960s. There has always been a difference between capability and intent when assessing Iran's nuclear ambitions. For its part, Iran has consistently maintained that while it seeks to master the nuclear fuel cycle, inclusive of large-scale enrichment of uranium, it does not intend to use this capability for military purposes. Indeed, Iran has linked this policy to the core foundation of what it stands for as a nation, its Islamic faith. The Islamic Republic of Iran has had two supreme leaders in its history. Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, and Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, both of whom have made it clear, through their words and deeds, that a nuclear weapon is anathema to their Islamic beliefs, and as such forbidden under Islam as practiced in Iran. The West might be dismissive of such public posturing by the national leaders, having grown accustomed to the common practice of its own leaders to say one thing and do another. However, in a nation such as Iran, where religious leaders are empowered by their respective hozas or seminary followings to issue fatwas or religious decrees derived from their juristic beliefs as expressed through a published risala amaliya or mutual of practical applications of their religious beliefs as they apply to society, the concept of a leader attaching religious significance to a decision only to do something else is unthinkable. While the United States of America during the Obama administration did make passing reference to the importance of the fatwa or religious decree issued by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about nuclear weapons, its policies never reflected that this understanding was anything more than superficial, a throwaway line used to distract from policies designed to undermine Iran rather than promote its nuclear energy ambitions. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime has maintained from the start that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program and has gone so far as to define nuclear weapons capability as being linked to the existence of a viable uranium enrichment capability, since, using Israeli logic, a nuclear weapon cannot exist without such capacity. In his opinion article, Ehud Barak ignores the role played by Israel in manufacturing a case against Iran regarding its nuclear intent. Ehud Barak denigrates the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement between Iran, Russia, China, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, the European Union, and lastly, the United States, finalized in July of 2015, in which Iran agreed to unprecedented restrictions and monitoring inspections in exchange for having economic sanctions linked to its nuclear program lifted, as failing to go far enough to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear capabilities. Ehud Barak ignores the fact that, as part of this agreement, the international community with Iran's cooperation thoroughly investigated a dossier of allegations regarding Iran's military intent when it comes to its nuclear programs that had been assembled primarily based upon Israeli intelligence, key aspects of which turned out to be pure fabrication, and found these accusations to be wanting. Seen in this light, the restrictions imposed on Iran by the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, were based upon the reality of its civilian nuclear program, as opposed to the malign fantasy being promulgated by Israel. And while Ehud Barak decries the decision by the United States to withdraw from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in 2018, his chief complaint is that neither the United States nor Israel prepared a Plan B for this eventuality. A large-scale military strike targeting the totality of Iran's nuclear infrastructure. Ehud Barak's solution isn't to find a way to work with Iran to create confidence in the international community regarding Iranian intent, but rather to focus on preparing sufficient military capability so that Israel would be able to eliminate Iranian nuclear capability altogether with a unilateral strike. This, of course, is no solution at all. Importantly, and quite scandalously, the Israeli regime is not the signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. It has repeatedly rejected calls to join the Keystone Accord of the International Arms Control Regime and refused to give United Nations Nuclear Agency, the IAEA inspectors, access to its nuclear sites. Despite the Israeli regime's dismissive approach, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has adopted a remarkably soft approach to the point that many see collusion between the two. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi's recent whirlwind trip to Tel Aviv, ahead of the United Nations Nuclear Agency's Board of Governors meeting in Vienna, lent credence to the plausible Israel-IAEA collusion theory. Rafael Grossi dashed off to Israel to discuss the anti-Iran resolution drafted by the United States and the European Troika with Israeli officials, aimed at mounting pressure on Iran to give up its legitimate demands. Does it make sense that the IAEA chief meets the head of an illegitimate regime which has secretly built a nuclear arsenal and refused to cooperate with the United Nations agency, the IAEA, to discuss the nuclear program of a country that has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, cooperated fully with the agency, and fulfilled all of its obligations? It smells of something deeply sinister and extremely despicable. Therefore, the West must accept the inevitability of Iran's nuclear ambition, limited in scope as it is to purely civilian purposes, and inclusive of a uranium enrichment capability derived from its mastering of the nuclear fuel cycle in its entirety. This program can either be monitored by the international community in accordance with the provisions contained within the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or in a less intrusive manner per Iran's existing obligations under the NPT. The choice is the West to make. Either way, however, Iran will exercise its rights under the NPT to pursue a peaceful civilian nuclear program. And no amount of threats from either Israel or the United States can stop this.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the growing military coordination between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying the Islamic Republic interprets the development as a direct threat to its national security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
In his message, Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces have already received written warnings from Iran, which sees the U.S. presence in the region as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, warnings, and conveyance of the message through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S. Army, we have declared and will declare our readiness and warning through expanding our presence, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European Command to CENTCOM in September of last year, with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy, and this is the first step in that strategy.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue to deepen cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S. brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal, the Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries as well as military and surveillance cooperation. Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plans to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation. In the absence of outlets for oppressed Palestinians to resist and tell their narratives, social media are one of the few tools at their disposal to counter Israeli disinformation campaigns. However, social media platforms, which were once heralded as means of free speech and liberation, have been complicit in the suppression and silencing of pro-Palestinian voices, a practice dubbed digital apartheid by some. Israel's attempts to erase the humanity of the Palestinians or whitewash its crimes against them continue unabated. Facebook's massive media monopoly, rebranded as Meta to save face from years of controversies surrounding it, is one of Israel's favorite ways to censor and control political debate in Palestine. Now, in a fresh crackdown on Palestinian social media content, several platforms owned by Meta have targeted accounts of dozens of pro-Palestinian individuals, including activists, writers, and journalists. Facebook and WhatsApp have closed many accounts for covering Israel's August bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip and reporting on Palestinian civilian deaths. The targeted individuals have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content. They say the social networking platforms have cited breaching their publishing standards for the crackdown.
I posted a number of photos detailing the civilians killed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip on August 17. They then accused me of breaching their publishing standards. But the real reason is clear. It's about cleansing the platforms of Palestinian content.
My first warning came when I published a photo of Adam Nablusi, who was killed by occupying forces. I was suspended from posting or commenting for 30 days while my posts were reviewed. I believe that the closure of my WhatsApp account is about stopping me publishing my journalistic work.
Sada Social, an initiative that records and monitors the suspension of Palestinian content and accounts on social media platforms, announced that Meta had mainly targeted activists based in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Nida Basumi, the media coordinator at Sada Social, says there has been an agreement in place between the Israeli regime and major social media networks since 2016 over controlling Palestinian content. She also pointed to double standards imposed by Meta when it comes to censoring content.
It launched an intensive campaign against Palestinian journalists by restricting social media posts reporting breaking news from Palestine. But it did not restrict the Israeli forces' video showing them raiding Nablus and killing Palestinians.
Israel and its allies are not only pressuring big tech to silence pro-Palestinian voices from outside. Facebook's Oversight Board, an independent body tasked with deliberating on the platform's content decisions, includes a former official at an Israeli ministry cyber unit, Emmy Palmer. She personally lobbied for the removal of thousands of pieces of Palestinian content from Facebook.
You know, it happens to all journalists all over the world, to all people who are pro-Palestinian all over the world. We have to fight with that. It's not only the Palestinian social media, it's all social media and all the people that ignore the narrative and are trying to do their jobs right. It's all the people that try to communicate a truth that the narrative doesn't like, the main narrative.
Since the very beginning, social media companies have collaborated with centers of power in the U.S. They even collaborated with the U.S. Department of Defense on surveillance and big data analysis. So it's not just a few influential pro-Israeli voices co-opting social media companies into silencing pro-Palestinian voices. The industry itself is rotten to its core.
As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, Moscow's warnings against the West for its punitive measures against the Kremlin continue to get tough. President Putin has now warned that Western sanctions against his country are hurting the entire world. Putin described the sanctions as short-sighted, saying the West has undermined the global economy with its aggressive attempts to impose its dominance on the world.
The United States has been pressing sanctions against Russia, individuals, private businesses, and state-owned enterprises. The European countries, most of which belong to the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, have gone along with this and have imposed their own sanctions. They're trying to cut back on the importation of Russian gas because that provides revenue for the Russian government. But they seem to have suddenly remembered that they import 30% of their gas from Russia.
Putin also said the West has been reluctant to recognize that, quote, irreversible and tectonic shifts have occurred in international relations. According to Putin, these shifts in international relations have led to the emergence of the Asia-Pacific region as a magnet for human resources, capital, and production capacities. The Russian president further said that Moscow found more opportunities in the markets in the Middle East after the West imposed sanctions on Russia. Putin also attributed the unfolding global economic crisis to Western elites who, quote, would not or even cannot acknowledge objective facts about global changes. He further said the US and its Western allies have tried to isolate Russia. But, according to Putin, it's impossible to isolate Moscow from the global economic and political landscape.
The problem for the United States ruling class at this point is that the world is becoming increasingly multipolar. It's no longer a situation where the United States can call the shots every area politically, economically, and even militarily. China is the second, the world's second largest economy, and is that economy is advancing more rapidly than that of the United States, and the United States views this as a tremendous threat because it's an economic competitor. The United States has been involved in wars throughout its history, but certainly intensely ever since World War II.
The crisis between the West and Russia has triggered unprecedented shifts in international alliances. After the war broke out between Russia and Ukraine, the US and its European allies tried to put Russia into a corner by imposing a raft of sanctions against Moscow. They put Russia's oil and gas industries, as well as its banking and insurance sectors, under heavy sanction. But the sanctions now appear to have backfired against Europe. Following the tensions, oil and gas prices surged to unprecedented levels. The high prices were beneficial to Russia, bringing huge profits to its oil and gas sector. Furthermore, Russia has forged closer ties with China, India, and Iran.
So, and meanwhile, Russia is now selling more oil to China and India at reduced cost, but they're selling it. So it looks like the sanctions are not going to hurt Russia nearly to the extent that the West hoped it would, and they're having repercussions on the standard of living of Europeans and North Americans, which only goes to show how integrated we are into a global economy. The sanctions are not producing the effect that the West wanted to. It's not bringing Russia to its knees, and it is also having deleterious effects on their own economies and their own peoples. So I think in that sense, President Putin was correct in his analysis.
Furthermore, the crisis put European countries into uncharted territory. Gas prices are rising dramatically in Europe following Russia's decision to stop gas exports to Europe. Moscow has cited Western sanctions as the reason for its decision and says it will not resume gas flow until Western sanctions are lifted. The energy crunch is now hurting European countries. There are now warnings of a harsh winter in Europe. There are already protests in several European countries against high costs of living and soaring prices. High electricity prices are hurting ordinary citizens in Europe as well as major businesses. Germany, which is considered Europe's biggest economy, is now on the brink of recession. Experts now warn that an economic downturn in Germany is unavoidable. And the recession in Germany will surely negatively affect the economy of the entire European Union.
It could have been dismissed as just another blast, but this was anything but that. An explosion at the entrance of the Russian embassy in the Afghan capital, which killed two Russian embassy staff members along with many civilians. The IS Khorasan or Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility, and this is where this attack is different from the others that Daesh has executed. This is the first attack claimed by the Daesh on a diplomatic mission in Afghanistan after the Taliban took over the country in 2021. This is important in many respects. The terrorist group first emerged in Syria and Iraq. It was a well-known fact that the US and its allies supported the group, especially in Syria.
And so it seems that Daesh, which was very likely actually created by the US military intelligence community, is once again serving as the sort of American Arab Legion. And they have, you know, they've never showed up anywhere outside of the sort of the Syria-Iraq region before. But just as the Taliban was making big progress in Afghanistan, suddenly Daesh came along and started attacking the Taliban and spreading chaos.
But then alarming news surfaced last year that they had moved to Afghanistan from the West Asia and posed a threat to regional security. The SCO last year raised the alarm when it announced that these terrorists were moved from Syrian and Iraqi conflict zones and posed a threat to the SCO member states. The Hezbollah Secretary General echoed the same sentiments. Said Hassan Nasrallah stated that according to reports he had received, the US's exit from Afghanistan pointed to Washington's role in transferring Daesh's terrorists from Iraq and the eastern bank of the Euphrates River to Afghanistan.
So this is a typical situation in which the U.S. government has done this all over the world in dozens of countries. They create terrorism to spread chaos in order to try to discredit the regime that they want to overthrow or hobble. And in this case, the reasons are obvious. The U.S. wants to win the great game. It wants to occupy the center of the grand chessboard in the struggle for Eurasia, as Brzezinski said. And it's losing, and it's trying to essentially win the war in Afghanistan by other means through supporting this obviously false flag terrorist group, so-called Daesh, which is purely and simply an American front.
It's now widely believed that the U.S., despite its hasty and disastrous departure from Afghanistan, still has plans for the resource-rich country. Iran's special representative for Afghanistan says even though the United States has withdrawn from Afghanistan, it supports terrorist groups such as Daesh to continue its role in the region. The Daesh and other Takfiri terrorist groups, in fact, continue the role of American soldiers in the region. I believe this is a real proxy war. We witnessed the same thing in Iraq and Syria. After its defeat in Iraq, the United States replaced its own forces with other groups to pursue the American goals in the region. There are speculations that given the backing of the US, this group will continue with its violence in Afghanistan. But what is their gain? For starters, the group's intention behind creating instability in Afghanistan may be to draw Iran into a conflict. It is a well-known fact that Iran is their number one enemy.
That they organized it around a kind of really extremist Salafi Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, or even really off, more extreme than even Salafi Wahhabis. And so they essentially took an element of thought from within sort of the more extremist people in Saudi Arabia and raised that to the nth power to create these total fanatics who are brainwashed into believing that they're right, everybody else is wrong, so everybody else needs their head chopped off. And the first people that whose heads they want to chop off are Shia Muslims. And that's very convenient for the U.S. because the U.S. is waging war not only against Russia and China, but also against Iran and the Axis of Resistance.
And given that the group had targeted the Russian embassy, it might want to provoke Russia into this scenario, which could turn Afghanistan into another Syria. Then there is the relationship between Daesh and the Taliban, which remains somewhat murky. At this point, the Taliban should be in charge of security for embassies, but they had failed with regards to Russia. And last year, even though the Taliban have publicly stated that there is no cooperation with the group, the country's neighbors like Iran will be watching Daesh terrorist group's actions very closely and how the